It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. While our physical schools are closed, school is in session on Talk of Iowa. On Tuesdays, the subject is biology, and on Thursdays, we explore Iowa history. Today, we're going to travel back in time a little over 75 years. To World War II. World War II started in Europe when Germany, led by Adolf Hitler, took over Czechoslovakia in March of 1939, and then later that year invaded Poland on September 1st. The United States entered the war after the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor in Hawaii on December 7th, 1941, a day that will live in infamy. The U.S. played a very important role as a member of the Allied forces. The Allies won the war with victory in Europe and Asia in 1945. And today, we're going to learn about Iowa during World War II. Leo Landis is here, curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa. Hello, Leo.
Good morning, Charity.
And Timothy Walsh, Director Emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. Hello, Tim.
Good morning, Charity and Leo.
And Tim, I think I just gave the world's shortest summary of World War II, which there's so much more to talk about. But let's talk about what it was like in Iowa during that time leading up to World
Sure.
War II, because, of course, we knew that it was coming.
In fact, I think it's a surprise in some cases for Americans and Iowans in particular to realize that between 1939, when Europe was very much at war, until 1941, the date that will live in infamy when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, Iowans had mixed feelings about whether or not we should go to war. And there was something called the America First Committee. Anyone who has read the book, The Plot Against America, by Philip Roth or seen the television series will know that there was a lot of isolationist impulse. And here in Iowa, there was a No Foreign Wars Committee that was led by Vern Marshall, who was the relatively famous editor of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. So there was a lot of isolationist impulse among Iowans, and not just Iowans, the Midwest in general. So they resisted, of course, until 1941, December 7th. Once we were at war, Iowans were all in, and that's where our story really begins, where we go shoulder to shoulder to fight the war, both in the Pacific and in Europe.
And in those years leading up to the U.S. entrance into World War II, Tim, was our military preparing? I mean, there was obviously a great deal of debate in the United States over whether we would be involved or not.
And this was a great challenge for FDR because, of course, he understood from Winston Churchill how badly Britain needed our support. But he also understood the American people weren't ready to go all in. We were moving in slow increments to get ready for war, but not nearly enough to meet the demand. What FDR did convince the Congress to pass and the country to support was the Lend-Lease Act. And in a fireside chat, FDR made it clear that we were just being good neighbors to Britain. He used the analogy of, if your neighbor's house was on fire, I'm sure you would lend him your garden hose to help him put the fire out. So what we were doing was lending or leasing ships and other war materials to Britain to help them fight the war. But we weren't going to enter the war at that point. But slowly but surely, FDR, and of course with the looming apprehension of war, and then the public opinion began to change. But it took time. FDR learned you can't push people, you have to lead them along. And that's what 1939 to 1941 was all about.
Well, and I also think it's important to bear in mind that World War I had taken place not very long before this. Many, many Americans, many Iowans, of course, had lived through that, experienced that, and that was a big part of that reluctance to join the war effort, right?
Exactly. In fact, Woodrow Wilson had gone to Europe with a plan, you know, the plan to the war to end all wars was what World War I was called. So the idea was we'd gone to Europe, and in fact, through much of the 20s and the 30s, many European nations still had war debts to the United States that they had suspended because of the Great Depression. So we were a little apprehensive about any entanglement. George Washington had warned us against foreign entanglements, and we took that to heart.
All right, Leo, you're up to bat. Let's go to Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941. Very briefly, for people who don't know that history, tell us what happened that day.
Sure. You know, there's still some debate about it, but most Americans, if not all, including the U.S. government, were surprised by the Japanese attack on December 7th, 1941. The attack began very early in the morning. It was a Sunday morning, 7:55 a.m., and you had the Japanese Air Force attacking the U.S. fleet that was in the harbor at Pearl Harbor, what is now the state of Hawaii, and it really devastated the U.S. Pacific fleet. It crippled the fleet. There were a number of Iowans there. I think there's at least still one Iowan, Francis Riley of Cedar Rapids, who's still alive. Harold Kramer, who was from Dubuque and then lived in Clinton, just passed away this month. He was a Pearl Harbor survivor, but it was a complete shock. And so the sailors were caught unawares for the most part and did their best to fight back. But it ended up, besides crippling the U.S. fleet, it also killed more than 2,500 American soldiers.
And I know that many of those men who were at Pearl Harbor have shared their story. Can you give us a little bit of insight into what it was like for those soldiers?
Sure. Iowa PBS did a great series of interviews, and some Iowa museums have some interviews, and we have accounts at the State Historical Museum, too, in our collections with the Historical Society. But one of the Iowa PBS interviews done in 2006 was Paul Ashbrenner, who grew up in near Sumner up in northeast Iowa, and he talks about being on the USS Oklahoma and just that the ship he was on had been hit, and he had shortly before that, minutes before that, heard that they were being attacked, and so it was all hands to stations, and he's below deck and is able to crawl his way up three decks and comes out in the water eventually, but with crude oil flowing through the ship and water coming into the deck he was on, and so it was really a struggle for all those men who were on board ships to try to protect their own lives and those of other servicemen and women.
Most of us have lived through news events that are shocking, the kind of thing that just stops you in your tracks. And of course, we're living through this pandemic right now, which is one of those events, although it didn't hit the news like an attack does. It didn't hit on just one day. Leo, I just think about what it was like to be an Iowan listening to the radio on December 7th, 1941, and learning that our nation was now at war.
And it was a complete shock to almost the entire country, if not the entire country. There is some debate, but it for the most part is established that there was no knowledge of the attack going to happen on December 7th. So, there was the idea that the Japanese were ramping up as well. They'd been fighting in Asia against the Chinese and other countries, and so Iowans and if you have an ancestor who is in their 90s or even 80s and was a child at the time, they'll remember, or a young adult, what it was like, and it is, there are stories of it was a fairly normal December day in the United States, and then
everything changed. Tim, when everything changed, suddenly the United States is at war, what changed in Iowa? What did Iowa do to prepare?
Well, first of all, yes, absolutely. And, of course, the attack on Pearl Harbor triggered our declaration of war on Japan for the attack on Pearl Harbor. But also then that triggered Germany declaring war on the United States. So all of a sudden, America was involved and Iowa was involved in a two-front war. And the War Department realized that they had to gear up very quickly and convert civilian industrial enterprises to a war campaign, and also, of course, to increase food production. Just as was the case in World War I, where the U.S. Food Administration had said food will win the war, So also in World War II, food would win the war. But the dilemma we faced as we, you know, encouraged young men to volunteer for military service, young farm boys and maybe their fathers as well, and certainly their brothers were going off to fight the war, and that left the fields and the farm work to mothers and daughters. And so there was a greater encouragement on the part of women to go into the fields. Eventually, there was something that the Agricultural Department set up called the Women's Land Army, another program to sort of teach women and to challenge women to get out there and to raise crops and to raise livestock, because, of course, we had to continue to feed not only our army but our civilian population. And then our allies, too, because Britain wasn't growing any crops, and we had to, we were the breadbasket for democracy in World War II, as we had been in World War I. It also, we've talked about rationing in previous shows, but there was, of course, rationing during World War II as well as World War I, where we had coupons and restrictions on what people could purchase, sugar and meat and gasoline and so forth. So everyone was required to do their part. And here in Iowa, it was it wasn't exclusively centralized on agriculture, but because so much of our economy was tied to agriculture and because food was so important to the war, we really geared up, along with other agricultural states, to raise the food to win the war.
Did that isolationism immediately disappear as soon as the United States joined the war effort?
Absolutely. It almost evaporated overnight. And as both you and Leo suggested, that shock on December 7th, I think it was a Sunday morning, and the power of radio, you mentioned that earlier, WMT and WHO, when that news came on, people were listening to a concert or something, and all of a sudden there was a news bulletin, and we had been attacked. Well, this was a shock to the system, and so we all geared up, and we were as patriotic as any state in the nation, as we had been in the Civil War and all other previous wars.
We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me today, Timothy Welch, Director Emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum, Leo Landis, Curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa. School is in session. We'll continue learning about Iowa during World War II. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. School is in session this hour. For the last few weeks, we've been learning about biology on Tuesdays and Iowa history on Thursdays. One more week left in the school year. But this summer, I do want to let you know that we will be having a virtual summer camp day every Tuesday throughout the summer for learners of all ages. We're going to do a lot of really fun stuff on Tuesdays throughout the summer. So we hope that you'll join us for that. This hour, we're talking about Iowa during World War II. And with me, Leo Landis, Curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa, Timothy Welch, Director Emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. And just before the break, we were talking about how once Pearl Harbor happened and the United States entered war, Iowa kicked into high gear in a number of different ways to support the war efforts. And Leo, of course, many men went to war, right? Tell me a little bit about what that looked like in Iowa.
There were, of course, more than 220,000 Iowa men and women did serve in armed forces during the war. And so there had been men who had enlisted before and were serving, as we talked about at Pearl Harbor, but also then with the promotional efforts through posters and other media, the government really recruits people hard, and men, as Tim alluded to, are signing up. So women also are then being invited to participate in activities as well. But a lot of men train here in Iowa, but also train across the nation and serve in all branches of the military, really, from the Army or the Army Air Corps and the Navy and the Marines, and also the Coast Guard. It was playing a major role as well.
And let's talk about what training was like in Iowa, because Fort Des Moines, of course, really became a hub for a lot of important training that took place during that time.
And Fort Des Moines, in this case, it gets its national landmark status for two reasons. It was the African-American officers who trained there in World War One, but in World War II, women across the United States were encouraged to help the war effort by filling administrative and other non-military or non-combat roles. And so in May 1942, President Roosevelt had issued a call for women to serve. And so that was the creation of the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps. And Fort Des Moines was the first base to take in women. They reported in July, training begins in August. A total of 150,000 women go through the WAC training program. That's what it was called, was WAC for Army Auxiliary Corps. And a total of about 65,000 train here in Des Moines.
And let's put this in perspective, because I know a lot of people growing up today take it for granted that women are a part of the military and all the different branches of the military and can even serve in combat roles. This was a really brand new and unique opportunity for women to be involved in meaningful work in the military, right?
It was. And just so I don't forget, the women accepted for volunteer emergency service. That was the Navy's version, the WAVES, and they trained up in Cedar Falls beginning in December of 1942. So Iowa has both those claims, and it really was a chance for women to experience, in a challenging way, either travel and serving in a way to help the nation. So you had women who were being trained to drive trucks at times, filling administrative roles. The women who were stationed in Des Moines with WACs were trained at the base, but then once they were put on permanent duty, they were staying at the Hotel Savory here in Des Moines. At Cedar Falls, they were staying in dorms up at Cedar Falls. And so it really was a chance to assist. So you had women from across the state and across the country coming into Des Moines and filling some of those roles that were the non-combat roles. But for the first time in a major way, other than being nurses, women serving in the U.S. Army and the U.S. Navy.
And I can imagine that a lot of women really found this to be a meaningful opportunity at a time when careers that women could pursue were still very limited. This was an exciting opportunity for a lot of women to get a different kind of education, to make some money, to support their families and to support themselves, and to travel the world.
And it got them, most of them did serve stateside, but it did get them across the country. We've got a WAC uniform in our collection from a woman from Muscatine. Her name was Ida Meekum. She trained here in Des Moines, but then went to Fort Oglethorpe in Georgia, then was stationed in the western United States. She trained through a Civil Air Patrol program in Muscatine, then enrolled in the WACs in 1944. And it was a chance for her to experience a broader world than she was a fairly dynamic woman. You see her name a lot as a young woman in Muscatine, but she was in her late 30s, early 40s when she signed up for the WACs, and then spends the rest of her life getting her PhD in biology and being an educator in Washington State.
You mentioned during World War One the fact that there were African-American men who were trained to be officers in Iowa, a very special moment in our history. African-American women were also welcome to be part of the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps, right?
That's exactly right. The first group of African-American women report at the same time that the first group of European American women or people with Latino ancestry, too. The only people that were segregated were African Americans, all other, at least in the WACs. So if you had Asian ancestry or Puerto Rican or Latino ancestry and were a WAC, you'd be not segregated. But women reporting to Fort Des Moines who were from outside the U.S. did, at least in most instances, report that while there might be some discrimination in Des Moines, it was much better experience than they had. So in some of their home states, and sometimes there are accounts of African-American women in the papers at the time who were serving saying, some of their European-American women were very friendly and would not go to restaurants that wouldn't serve African-Americans to make sure that they could dine together.
Although it is worth noting, of course, that segregation was a reality throughout World War II, and this was during a really dark time in our country for segregation and for equality in many, many ways.
Exactly, and Edna Griffin, who was a WAC and then ends up coming to Des Moines, she and her friends have to desegregate the Katz drug counter after World War II. So there was segregation in Des Moines even at that time.
We talked a little bit about men jumping into service. Let's talk about some of the individuals in Iowa who were such a big part of the war effort. Some of those stories that, of course, have been told and retold. I want to talk about the five Sullivan brothers. And Tim, do you want to talk about them? Or?
Sure. Okay. Of course, service, military service, was very personal to just about every Iowan, and any Iowa family that had a young man in service would display a blue star that was given to them, I think, by the Office of War Information, that indicated that they had a young man in service. And if you lost a son, then that star would be converted to a gold star. And there was no other household, I think, in the United States that had as many stars as the Sullivan family of Waterloo. They had five gold stars because of the extraordinary circumstance, first of all, that allowed all five Sullivan brothers not only to volunteer, but to serve in the same assignment, which was on the SS Juno. They had agreed all for one, one for all. Two of the brothers had served earlier. I think George and Frank had served earlier, and so the Navy agreed to let all five serve. And in November of 1942, November 13th, the Juno was sunk by a Japanese torpedo. Through a mix-up, there were no rescue efforts initially to try to recover any of the bodies. Apparently, three of the Sullivan brothers had died immediately, and then two others had survived for some time thereafter, but eventually succumbed. And so you had this horrendous loss of life, five lives. And the Navy Department at the time, of course, had to go to the household. Tom Sullivan, the father, was getting ready for work. They knocked on the door. He knew with five sons the likelihood that they would lose one or maybe two. And when the Navy chaplain was there at the door, Tom said, "Which one?" And unfortunately, the response that came back was all five. Well, the country embraced the Sullivans. They became the nation's family, the nation's grief. And Tom and Alida Sullivan traveled to various war industry locations to try to spur morale. Alida Sullivan would say, "You're all my sons now." Eventually, Hollywood would do a film called The Fighting Sullivans in 1944. That appeared in theaters and talked about what life was like, actually, because it wasn't about the war. It was about what the Sullivan life was like in Waterloo, Iowa. So for many people who, of course, isolated in the country, hadn't traveled ever to Iowa, saw what typical life was, well, at least how Hollywood typified life in Iowa at that time. So the Sullivans epitomized sacrifice. And, of course, they were sons of Waterloo, Iowa. And today, of course, there's the Five Sullivan Center and many other memorials to the Sullivans for that sacrifice.
And they also left behind a sister. There are descendants of the Sullivan family. And it also changed policy for the military, right?
Yes. Yes, they the Navy agreed even at that time that the decision to allow all five to serve in one assignment on one ship was not only extraordinary but poor policy, and so absolutely thereafter that was changed. And in fact, it's kind of a thread of some continuity in the film Saving Private Ryan, where and I think the character, the Ryan character, has several brothers in service. And they're going to retrieve the surviving brother, and that's the assignment in the film.
We're talking about Iowa during World War II. We'd love to hear your questions and your stories. You can call us at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We also have some support materials on our website, iowapublicradio.org. You can find some vocabulary questions or vocabulary words and discussion questions as well. And Paul is on the line in Story City. Hello, Paul.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. And you have an uncle who was a Pearl Harbor survivor?
Yeah, by the way, I'm a radio person myself. Yeah, he was at Schofield Barracks at Pearl Harbor. And it was 7:55 in the morning. A bomb actually hit the corner of the barracks there. He got up to go to the latrine, and while he was gone, a bomb hit his area of the barracks and killed several men and destroyed his clothing and all that sort of thing. And so he always called that his golden opportunity to go to the latrine, because he was absent from his cot at the time of the explosion. But I'd also like to say that, you know, Winston Churchill, he was such a prescient guy. You know, he could sort of predict some things. And he, when he, of course, he was being beaten all over the world. You know, Germany had occupied Europe, and they were in the midst of the Blitz and all the problems they had. And when he heard about Pearl Harbor, he said, "So, we've won after all." Because he knew what the industrial might of America would bring into the conflict. So he was really prescient about that.
And then Babe Bisignano, he was right.
Well, Babe Bisignano from Babe's Restaurant, he used to tell the story that, hey, you know, people used to have, these bomber pilots would have all the sudden engine trouble over Des Moines. They'd have to land because they came to my restaurant because all of the wax at Fort Des Moines. They'd all have engine trouble at the right time.
Oh, Paul, that is a great story. Thank you so much for calling and sharing that with us today. You're welcome to join the conversation as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And Leo, before we get to the break, I want to talk about a really unique contribution made by Meskwaki soldiers from Iowa. Tell us about that.
That's right. And my colleague Mary Bennett in the Historical Society in Iowa City has done a really great article on them. There were 8 Meskwaki men. There were actually more than that. There were 27 Meskwaki men who had enlisted in the Iowa National Guard in early 1941. So as we said, Iowa men were signing up even before Pearl Harbor. But there were 8 men from the settlement, Frank and Willard Sinashi, Dewey Roberts, Edward Benson, Melvin Twin, Dewey Young Bear, and then a pair of brothers, Judy Wayne Wabanasi and Mike Wayne Wabanasi, and they were in Company H of the 168th, and they were being used as some of the code talkers that are better known. Story is that they were enlisting and being trained to use their native language so that their communications couldn't be stolen by the Germans, and so were able to foil people listening in to transmissions by using the Meskwaki men.
Right, and a number of native languages were used in this way because they weren't well-documented languages, and they created unbreakable codes, right?
Exactly right, and one of the stories, at least, that is in a great article that Mary did was that, you know, initially some of the Meskwaki men were not happy about being asked about their native language, but when they learned that it was important for the war effort, they were proud of that.
They, of course, with so many Meskwaki men, they had different fates. A few of them wound up as prisoners of war, right?
That's right. Some of them were captured, and so I don't know that any Meskwaki men died in service. I apologize for that, but in World War II, at least in battle, but more than 50 total ended up serving, and they were active in the American Legion and are still proud of the service they've given to the United States.
Absolutely. And we're talking about Iowa during World War II today. We've talked a lot about how Iowa was supportive on the home front. Of course, many soldiers went to war. Many women went to war in the Women Auxiliary Corps and also the Waves, the WAX and the Waves. And we also played kind of an unusual role, something that I think is a surprise to a lot of people. We don't have time to dig deep into it right now, but Tim, we also housed prisoners of war from Europe, right?
We did. We did. There was, in fact, Leo, I think, could add to this, too. I know there was one camp at Algona, and what I want to do is to set the scene, because, of course, they brought these German prisoners, very few Japanese. I don't think there were any Japanese prisoners of war here, but German prisoners who came and worked in the agricultural industry, detasseling and doing other farm chores. And, of course, this was exciting and exotic for those young boys around Algona. And they all went out and got sharpened sticks and went out to the fields with their sticks to make sure that they could guard these Germans to make sure they didn't escape. Well, where would these Germans go? They
right.
didn't speak English. They'd have to try to wander off. But it brought the war home for a lot of young boys who, of course, were learning about war and geography by reading the newspapers and then meeting these extraordinary prisoners. So it was a big event.
Right. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. With me today, Timothy Walsh, Director Emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum, and Leo Landis, Curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa. We're talking about Iowa during World War II. You're welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100 or tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. School is in session today as we explore Iowa history. We're talking about Iowa during World War II. And you are welcome to join the conversation, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Timothy Walsh, Director Emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum, and Leo Landis, Curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa. And just before the break, we were talking about the fact that there were prisoners of war from Europe that were housed in Iowa. They did their service doing farm work and other kinds of work here in Iowa. Algona was one of the places where German prisoners of war were kept. And Leo, we also had Italian prisoners of war, right?
That's right. And in fact, there were two camps, as Tim alluded to, the Algona camp and there was also a camp down in Clarinda. And it was Italian prisoners who helped build those two camps. And then later in the Iowa City area, there were some men kept, Italian prisoners kept there, usually in smaller numbers. And those men helped doing work around hospitals. I know at the Clinton Hospital that was active at the time, some of the Italian prisoners did that work as well. And as Tim said, they were often at the two larger camps used for agricultural work. But any kind of road work that needed human labor, those Italian and German prisoners would be put to work.
And the German prisoners in Algona left behind a really beautiful treasure that, of course, you can still see in Algona. Leo, tell us about that.
That's right. Late in the war, and in fact, it had really, for the most part, ended. Some of the German prisoners up in Algona fashioned a nativity scene with large characters for the nativity, the Christian nativity, and it's still on display at the Kossuth County Fairgrounds in Algona through every Christmas season. And so there was a relationship that developed between the communities at times with some of the prisoners who were serving out their prisoner of war time in those towns.
I want to go to the phones. We have a lot of people who want to share their stories. We'd love to hear from you at 866-780-9100. Virginia is on the line in Corydon. Hello, Virginia.
Hello, Charity.
Oh, thank you so much for calling. And this is part of your history. Tell us about it.
Well, I'm 94 years old, and in 1943, I graduated from high school. I grew up on a farm in northern Iowa. And in the summer of 43, I was accepted into the St. Mary's Hospital School of Nursing in Rochester, Minnesota. And in that summer, before I went into training in the fall, I received a letter from St. Mary's that we would be the first class who would have our training paid for through the government, and we were called the Cadet Nurse Corps. That was what it was called. And so my training was paid for by the government through the Cadet Nurse Corps for those 3 years.
And as a member of the Cadet Nurse Corps, what did that mean about where you would work and how you would repay the government for that education?
Well, by the time, if we had, the war had been still going on, we would have been required to go into one of the services to work as a nurse. But the war ended in 1946, yeah. So that I was never required to go in or to repay. Now, there were other people who went in later. I had friends who went in and who were, I think, required to go into service. But I wasn't.
Right. Virginia, before I let you go, you were in high school when Pearl Harbor happened. Do you remember when you heard the news?
I do. My parents and my sister and I were at dinner with my mother's sister and her family, and we had the radio on, and we heard it, right? Then that announcement over probably WHO, maybe. I don't know.
Do you remember what you felt, how people reacted?
We were horrified. We were shocked. And I recently attended a family reunion with one of the women who was my first cousin. Mm-hmm. And we had a conversation about that day. Because she was one of the women that, or one of the girls that I was at dinner with.
Oh, well.
So we remembered it.
Yeah, that's not the kind of thing you would ever forget. Virginia, thank
never,
you so
ever.
Much for sharing your story with us today. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. I'm going to go next to Joe in Waukee. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Hi. What's your story?
Thanks. Well, my dad was one of those Iowa boys who grew up in small town Iowa and enlisted immediately when he got out of high school. He actually wasn't even 18 years old yet and lied about his age and signed up. And he was sent to the South Pacific as in the Marines, and he fought at four of the big battles there, Corregidor and Guadalcanal, and he was at Tarawa, which, if you know anything about South Pacific war history, was an absolute bloodbath. Survived all of that, and then fought on Saipan and was wounded on the last day that his unit saw action. So the day after he was wounded, his division was pulled out. But there's a lot of fascinating aspects to my dad's story, but the most fascinating is his foot was shredded by a Japanese hand grenade, and they rushed him down the mountain to the beach and took him out to the hospital ship in the bay, and he died on the operating table. They took him down to the morgue, and the story varies a little bit, a day and a half or 2.5 days. The period of time kind of lengthened over the years when he told the story. But basically, a day and a half after being in the morgue for a day and a half, somebody realized he wasn't dead. And they rushed him back up to the operating room, and his entire leg had to be amputated. Because of the gangrene, instead of just losing his foot, he lost his whole leg. But he was, you know, it was a miracle that he survived it. And so I grew up with a dad with one leg who was very grateful every day to be alive and able to have a family and play golf and do all the things he did.
Yeah, what an incredible story, Joe. Thank you so much for sharing that story. And Tim, we're not going to be able to dig into it today. Of course, all of the men and the women who survived their service in the war, they came home to Iowa. And life changed dramatically here after the war, but they also carried those experiences with them. I don't know about Joe's dad, but I had an uncle who really couldn't talk about what happened to him in World War II, and he was on the beach at Normandy, and clearly that was something that stayed with him forever. So these experiences changed people, and they really changed our culture after the war, didn't they?
Absolutely. In fact,
Library of Congress established a Veterans History Project to do oral histories late in life for many, many veterans. But it's these World War II veterans who are being interviewed by their grandchildren, maybe even great-grandchildren, and for the first time telling these stories. You're absolutely right. They came back from war, and they just wanted to reestablish a sense of order. And thanks to the GI Bill, they got cheap loans to buy a home if they'd like to do that, or to go back to school. Folks who, of course, are now they're older, but they remember the Quonset huts at the University of Iowa and other temporary housing at ISU and UNI, because so many young men went back to college for the first time. But they pushed those memories of wartime behind them. And as we began to celebrate the 50th anniversary of World War II and then other anniversaries thereafter, we've gone back to them and said, please recall your memories, because these are singular events in their lives, as were the events of the Civil War. So wartime tends to be a tremendous paradigm shift in the personal life of certainly Iowa farm boys, but Americans in general.
Let's go back to the phones. Wally is on the line in New Hampton. Hi, Wally.
Hi. I just wanted to call you. We were speaking earlier about the German prisoner of war camp. My uncle, my mom's brother, served in the Army, and he was captured in the Battle of the Bulge. And he spent time in the concentration camp, Stalag 9. And after they were released from the prisoner camp, he was able to come back home, and he still had time to serve. So they assigned him to be a guard of the German prisoners in Algona.
Oh, wow.
So he was both a prisoner and a guard of the German prisoners.
Yeah. Oh, Wally, that is fascinating. And Leo, I think one of the things that is interesting that we should note, of course, many, many Iowans are of German descent. And we were at war with Germany. We were at war with Germany in World War I. We were at war with Germany in World War II. And that created some conflict on the home front. I know particularly during World War I, there was a lot of discrimination against the Germans who had emigrated to the United States, who lived in Iowa. How did that play out during World War II?
In World War II, there was still some anti-German sentiment, but I think the service of Germans and German Iowans in World War I proved their loyalty for the most part. There was almost more concern about the patriotism of Italian Americans. So we've got a great photograph in our collection that came from the Des Moines Register of a loyalty ceremony of Italian Americans showing that they were going to support the war effort, and a swearing-in ceremony from the Italian-American Catholic community in Des Moines. So for the most part, I mean, there was still anti-German sentiment, but the concern was more, of course, and again, there are Asian concentration camps in the western United States, and so that story is well known, not as a big a story in Iowa, but there was concern about Italian-Americans' mm-hmm. loyalty.
Well, we've got time for a couple more stories from listeners. Barb is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Barb. Hi, Barb. Are you there?
Yes. Hi. My father, in 1942, was drafted. He was a large animal veterinarian, and he was drafted into the veterinary corps. And all when I was growing up, I heard about this veterinary corps in World War II, but I never heard it other than from my mother and father. And then a few years ago, I was in New Orleans, and I went to the World War II museum there, and they had an exhibit, and it was like, this really happened. Dad did do, veterinary work in he was in Burma and in China, and he went in as an officer for some reason, and he talked very little about the war, but he talked about having dinner with Chiang Kai-shek and his wife, and Dad really talked more about Mrs. Chiang Kai-shek than the leader there. because I guess she had gone to Vassar or something and probably had better English or whatever. And we have hanging in our living room a commemoration that I guess the Chinese government did following World War II to try and acknowledge what Americans had done. And it is signed by Chiang Kai-shek, a former colleague of mine, Will Zhang, who's a Chinese-American out at DMAC, translated the whole thing for me and showed me where my father's name is and where Chiang Kai-shek's signature is.
Oh, Barb, thanks so much for sharing that story. And Leo, we only have about 3 minutes here. There are so many Iowa connections to World War II. Of course, this was transformative really for the entire globe in so many ways. As hopefully the threat of COVID-19 recedes, there are lots of great opportunities that you can take advantage of to learn about World War II. But even before it does, there's so much more to explore. Can you give us some ideas of maybe some places to look to learn about World War II and our role in it?
Sure. The Iowa Gold Star Military Museum has a great exhibit on the Iowa experience from a military perspective in World War II. The Sullivan Brothers Museum in Waterloo, part of the Grout Museum District, has excellent displays. We have some of our World War II display collections on display in our Visible Vault exhibit at the State Historical Museum. So you can search our catalog online, too. So that's something we offer if you have a question. One of the collections we have, and I will be brief, is there were three balloon bombs, at least, that the Japanese, late in the war, were using the jet stream to try to launch bombs to North America and the United States to terrorize Americans about the war. And it was a maybe late last-ditch effort. We have fragments of one in our collection, but they usually landed in northwest or west northern Iowa. So one landed in Lorenz, one landed near Pocahontas, and one landed near Holstein. So we've got fragments of one in our collection.
And did they actually explode?
The one story that I know best, or the two, the Lorenz and Pocahontas bombs never exploded. They were able to be diffused. The Lorenz one, they put on display, and then the federal government came in and said, do not talk to people about this. We do not want it getting out.
Wow.
One did kill six people in Oregon.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we are out of time. There's so much more we could talk about. And we will do a program later this summer about the Manhattan Project and Iowa connections to the atomic bomb as well. Leo Landis, thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure, Charity.
Leo Landis, curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa. Timothy Walsh, thank you.
Thanks, Charity, and thanks, Leo.
Timothy Walsh, Director Emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. Again, check out our website for some support materials as we learn about Iowa history. iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa.